That was Mind Rain by drummer Joe Chambers. It comes from the album Double Exposure from 1977, and that's Chambers on piano with Larry Young on organ. You may recognize a little bit of the groove there as a very famous hip-hop sample. Joe Chambers is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance podcast, which is part of the Osiris Network. This is episode 63 of the show and our second episode of 2021. It was meant to be the third episode. I had a really interesting interview with Lafayette Gilchrist, a pianist from Washington, D.C., in the can. Unfortunately, I had some computer issues and the file got deleted. So all I'll say is go to Bandcamp, look up Lafayette Gilchrist, G-I-L-C-H-R-I-S-T, because his music is fantastic and well worth your time and money. Also worth your time and money are the first two releases on our new label, Burning Ambulance Music. They're available exclusively on Bandcamp, and they are Alkiza by the Indonesian avant-garde drone metal duo Senyawa, and Polarity, a duo album by saxophonist Ivo Perlman, who was my guest on the last episode of 2020, and trumpeter Nate Woolley. I'm really happy about the reception that both of these albums have been getting. They've both been reviewed in The Wire, and the Ivo and Nate album was written up in Downbeat, and there was actually an article about Senyawa in the New York Times, for which I was interviewed. So I'm confident that when people hear the albums, they'll be as thrilled by the music as I am. If you want to buy them, you can visit burningambulancemusic.bandcamp.com. There's no place else to do it. No stores, no Amazon, and they're not going to be on any streaming services like Spotify or Apple Music or Tidal. We're a small operation. We're aimed at people who really want to support the artists they like. So please visit burningambulancemusic.bandcamp.com to listen to Senyawa and Ivo Perlman and Nate Woolley. And if you like what you hear, buy the records. And if you enjoy this show or the website, I hope you'll consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month. It really helps us to create more and better content, so become a subscriber if you can. Okay, so Joe Chambers. The man is a legend. I mean, he made his name in the early 1960s, playing on a whole string of some of the most adventurous Blue Note Records sessions of the time. He can be heard on albums like Bobby Hutcherson's Dialogue, Wayne Shorter's The All-Seeing Eye, Andrew Hill's Compulsion, McCoy Tyner's Tender Moments. He also backed Archie Shepp on Fire Music, New Thing at Newport, and a couple other records. He was the drummer on Chick Corea's debut album, Tones for Jones Bones. He maintained a particularly long creative relationship with Hutcherson. The two men made something like 10 albums together over a period of many years. Chambers didn't record as a leader until the 1970s, but as I mentioned right at the start, Mind Rain from Double Exposure was prominently sampled by DJ Premier for New York State of Mind from Nas's debut album, 1994's Illmatic. On his own new album, Samba de Maracatu, Chambers reworks that piece as New York State of Mind Rain. I think this is a really interesting conversation about Chambers' long career as both a musician and an educator, and about his perspectives on jazz and drumming generally. It was recorded just a few days after legendary free jazz drummer Milford Graves passed away, and Chambers has some opinions on free jazz that I don't necessarily agree with, but he's absolutely earned the right to have them, so I'm happy to share them with you all. I hope you'll enjoy listening to this interview as much as I enjoyed doing it. I'm going to play another piece of music now. This is Visions from his new album, Samba de Maracatu, and on this track he's playing both drums and vibes. So listen to that, and afterwards you'll hear my interview with Joe Chambers. Thank you.
Mr. Chambers?
Yes, it is.
This is Phil Freeman. How are you, sir?
How you doing? I'm good.
Good, good.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
Where are you geographically?
I'm in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Oh, okay. Okay. How's the weather down there?
It's good. Better than there's no snow. We don't get snow down here.
Ah, okay.
It may get a little chilly, but it's a few about 40, 50 miles from South Carolina, right in there. We get the Florida kind of northern Florida kind of weather.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so it's just really good.
Yeah.
Year round.
So okay. I guess we should just dive right in.
Go ahead.
Okay, so you play drums, piano, and vibraphone.
Well, I'm percussion. I'm percussion. All of that's percussion. I'm not a piano player. I just play arrangers play piano, what you could call arrangers piano. You know, most musicians play some piano.
Uh-huh.
You know, I may play a little more than the average. I don't consider myself a piano player. Let's get that straight up front. But I do know, I know a lot of keyboard, you know, a lot of theory, a lot of chords and stuff. And I do consider myself a mallet player these days. I consider myself a formidable mallet player.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and the drums, you know, that's been for a year, forever. But, you know, vibes and drums, and see, people forget if they even know, the vibraphone is a percussion instrument. It's percussion. It's an instrument that you strike. So it's right in line with actually playing drums.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, let me ask, where did you start? Did you start on drums, or did you start on, you know, mallet instruments, or where did you begin?
No, I started on drums.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, in actuality, piano. I started playing lessons way back when I was little, but I couldn't continue the piano lessons in those days, the way they went about it. And so drums, I had the drumming instincts from early on. So I would say, I'm a drummer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I started on drums first.
That was your, like, for real instrument, as opposed to being told you're going to play the piano as a kid.
You could say that. But I'm glad I did continue with the piano when I was a teenager and all throughout. I'm glad I did. I started really studying keyboard, you know, after high school. And that actually helped me with the mallets. I got into mallets around 1970 when Max Roth called me and Warren Smith and we formed the percussion group M Boom. That's when I got into it.
Oh, okay.
Because we all had to play. We all had to learn how to play the percussion, that exists in our society. You know, which consists of mallets. We all had to learn how to play the mallets. We all had to learn how to play the timpani, correct? And we had to learn how to play conga drums, hand drums, which was why we got Ray Mantia. And of course, all of those shakers and all that stuff, you have to, there's techniques to that. So,
yeah.
That's when I got into the mallets. Seriously, I guess you'd say, yeah.
Okay. And before that, you had made like 10 albums with Bobby Hutcherson. So, I mean, were you like watching?
Oh, yeah.
you watching from behind the kit?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, it was. When I think about that, then I never, when we worked together back in those days with Bobby and Harold, and then I never really, that's because I was still really focused on playing drums, you know, but I never saw the, I never thought about the vibes, the vibraphone, like that, until one time he actually, Bobby said, yeah, I like to do something with just vibes and drums. He said that. I remember, I don't know when it was, but, and then I started, I said, oh, wow, yeah, that's right. So, and of course, when Max called us and we saw that there it is, that's the percussion. It's percussion.
Mm-hmm. Now, M-Boom, when you guys were performing, I mean, with that many percussion instruments and stuff like that, was that heavily arranged music, or was there, you know, how much improvisation,
yes, was
there
heavily,
possible?
It was,
or
heavily,
was it?
Well, see, that's the whole thing about, you know, people, when they think about, I don't, maybe not you. Are you a musician? Of such,
barely.
Okay.
I mean, instrument,
right,
I was forced to play in like the third grade was the violin, and then, you know,
mm-hmm,
there's a trumpet in the house. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. No, I was going to say, you know, jazz is very highly, highly and very contained. You know, it's really highly structured, unless you're playing free jazz, you know, but even free jazz. So, in regards to M-Boom, yes, we approached it, there's several ways to approach percussion. And the way I approached it was like a small quintet, small band. Timpani can play the bass lines, and then you got chords can be played by mallets, and then you got a melody. Like that, but you can put percussion. You can also look at it as textures, like woods, metals, all metallic and all wood, and just deal with it that way. So that, I mainly approach it like a small jazz band. So I wrote arrangements. Everybody, we all wrote arrangements. I wrote arrangements, and we have solo section, you know, just like jazz, you know, you get solo, have an improv section, boom, take the head out like that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, because, yeah, my conception of it was more in the way of, like, a composer like Steve Reich would do music for, like, four marimbas, you know, or something like that, where it was complex,
yeah, well,
sort of patterns.
Yeah, well, not through compose. You know, Steve Reich, I'm familiar with Steve Reich. I know that he's a composer, and he probably wrote through compose. That is, just all thing, everything written. No improv at all. That may have some improv, but no, we didn't do that. We didn't do that. Because one thing is, we didn't have music on the stand. No music on the stage.
Oh.
No music. Yeah, we no music on the stage. That was Max Rose. No, we don't have music on the stage. No. Boom.
Yeah, there's some groups that have that as a rule now, but it's not that common. I see a lot of sheet music when I go to, you know, when I was going to gigs before, you know, back when there were gigs.
All right. Yeah. Well, even I would say, unless you got a tight band, you know, you got a tight working band, you don't need music, but you get a group, a lot of groups are just put together, you know, so you do need music. You need parts. You can play the heads, and you maybe reading chords, so you see music. But I specifically remember Max Roach saying when we started, no, we're not going to have no music on the stand. Boom. And that's a good thing, really.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to learn everything. We learn and memorize everything. And there was a lot of written stuff. A lot of my tunes were written, extremely written parts.
When you were doing, like, because you were on a bunch of Blue Note albums in the 60s, And the guys that you seemed to work with the most were Bobby Hutcherson, like we said, and Wayne Shorter and Andrew Hill. And all three of those guys at that time seemed like you were kind of trying to stretch the boundaries of hard bop, like you were inside and outside kind of at the same time. I mean, what can you say
about that is true. Especially Wayne and all three of them, really, but Wayne's stuff is Wayne was he's one of the best, greatest composers currently, but his stuff was very way out. It was very extremely stretched chord formulations, and Bobby was too, and Andrew was. But the one thing, there was a writer, he passed, Stanley Crouch, you heard of him?
I've heard of him. We never met, but I've read his stuff.
Yeah, well, he said one thing. He said he passed very recently. Anyway, he said, and they were talking about the so-called avant-garde, and then there was an avant-garde by title back in the 60s, early 60s, and he said to me, and I never thought of this, he said, well, the avant-garde, the real avant-garde was what you guys were doing on Blue Note, not the Albert Alliers and John Chakaias, just to throw out some names. And I had actually never thought about it that way, and I had no resentment against those people. And then he said, well, the real avant-garde was y'all, because you guys, you could hear the blues and what you were doing. You could swing, we could swing, and it's like we are an extension. We extended what went before. We could extend it off the chords, never really abandoned chord structures.
Mm-hmm.
So then I saw, all right, you got a point. So, well, that's what he said.
Yeah.
And like I said, at the time when I was in that, and we were talking about the early 63 and all that, when I came there, and it was a so-called avant-garde scene at that time. Archie Shepp was retarded, but Shepp now, he plays inside, what we call inside. He had Albert Alliers, John Chakaias, those type of people, let alone, Cecil, people like Cecil Taylor. Because he was, and Ornette Coleman.
Yeah.
So
it's interesting to me the way free jazz has become a language.
Yeah, what they were calling free jazz
over the course of however many years. Like now, people play in that style as a tradition.
Right. Well, yeah, it is, and it was a language then, and it has become something of it, but. When I think about what we were doing, I mean, we, like the Bobby Hutcherson and the dates with Andrew Hill and Wayne Shorter and E. McCoy, and all the people that I recorded, they never abandoned the chords. The chords were always there.
Mm-hmm.
They wrote a piece that had a structure that had chord changes, and they never abandoned the chords. They may have stretched on the chords, but they never abandoned the chords, and they never tried not to swing. It was always going to play some kind of pulse.
So
with all of that music, yeah.
So since you were the guy who was doing a lot of these records, what do you think about your approach to the drums was the right fit? Like, for, when you were working in that era, like, why would somebody call you for a session like that and not call, say, Billy Higgins?
I don't know. I can't answer that. I don't know. I literally cannot answer that. All I know was I was getting the calls, and You know, I showed up in rehearsal and boom, hit, made the dates. One thing, well, I think I might, that, a good answer to that might also be what I just said about we playing inside the chords. And one time Herbie Hancock told me, he said, the word is that if you want somebody to that can play some swing and play with a Latin feel, get you. That's what he told me.
Did you have a big affinity for Latin stuff when you
Absolutely.
Were coming up?
Always did. Always have. Always have. I mean that literally since I was real little. Yeah, I always liked the Afro-Cuban, the Mambo, Rumba. Not so much Brazil back then, but it was always Afro-Cuban music was always here in my neighborhood and especially in New York. But I didn't grow up in New York. I grew up in Philly, in Philly area. But it was still Latin, heavy Latin music, Latin shows, Latin radio shows, playing the Cuban music, there, which was the Afro-Cuban,
mm-hmm.
what they call salsa now. But really, it's rumba, mambo, rumba, wah-wah. Cuban wah-wah-co. I've always liked that from the very beginning, and always had an affinity for it. So
yeah, it's interesting. I read an interview with Milford Graves, who just passed this last week.
Yeah,
and he said that he started out playing timbales, and so when he sat down behind an actual drum kit, he had to like figure out what to do with his feet because it had never been required of him before that.
Well, yeah, that's why I never knew that he played Latin. I don't know if he played Latin, but I didn't know that he played timbales.
Yeah, I saw a photo of him from 1961 where he was in the same band with Chick Corea, actually. And Chick was on piano and Milford was on timbales, and then there was a conga player and a bassist.
Whose band was it?
A guy named Montego Joe, who was like a Jamaican.
Oh, Montego Joe. Yeah. I know Montego Joe. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, when Milford was like 20 or something, that was what he was doing. But what was your impression of guys like him or Rashid Ali or Sonny Murray, who were kind of trying to break down time and like expand the role of the drums in a way?
You know, here's the thing about drums. The drums we play here, the kit and all of that. I'm going to put it, I'm trying to be diplomatic. Now, those guys, Milford and even Rashid, and they're both of them are past. I can't believe that Milford ever played timbales or ever played Latin music, what they call Latin. It's hard to believe because that music, that rhythm is so contained. It's so contained, and the patterns are so. And the way he went to playing, the way him and Rashid that style of playing is not. I don't know. I never really liked it. I could put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you see those. The music that accompanied what they were doing was never really highly. That wasn't that great. Wasn't that highly structured anyway. So. They were out of the role of the fundamental role of rhythm instruments like a drum. It's the fundamental role is to accompany. You have to accompany, and you have to play pulse. I say pulse instead of time. There's a difference between time and pulse. And pulse-oriented music, like jazz, which is a pulse, is because it comes out of a dance. It comes out of a dance, like the Latin music. It comes, it's connected to dance. So, I never really. I'm being truthful. What Milford was doing from a drumming, just from a drumming, was never interesting to me, and Rashid too. There was no, because they weren't. They weren't playing tang, tang, and tang, man. They weren't swinging. They wouldn't come on out of a swing. you had to come out of that. So
mm-hmm.
I never, they weren't doing anything, as far as I'm concerned. And they went their way, And I know Coltrane hired Rashid at a certain point when he was trying to get into a circular rhythm. But, you know, after Elvin Jones, it's just like, yeah, forget it, man, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, let's talk about your new record then, because on the new record, you play drums and then you overdub the vibes. So,
right.
You were, but obviously you were composing with the vibes in mind, right? So were these pieces like written on piano, or how did you, how did you write the
stuff? Well, I wrote those pieces. Most of those pieces were written, they were old. They were old pieces. I play arranger piano, but I play enough piano. I play enough piano that I could play. I did a solo record. I'm well versed in theory, in Western harmonic theory, chord structure, all of that. This is a fact. I'm well versed. And I'm a very good arranger and orchestrator for large orchestra. So it's all just second nature to me.
Mm-hmm.
So playing the, I've said this about going to vibes, and some vibe players, vibraphone specialists, they may get a little agile. I said, man, playing vibes was really easy. Here's the point, okay. I'm not comparing myself to the late Bobby Hutcherson or Joe Locke or any of the players today, but I can get over the vibes. I can get over them very easily. It was no problem getting to it, first of all, because I already played piano. I knew the keyboard, so it was just a matter of getting the sticking down, which I'm still getting the sticking down.
Mm-hmm.
So it's no big deal.
Who are the other two musicians that are on the record with you, the pianist and the bassist, and why did you choose them?
Well, this is North Carolina. All right, where are you calling from?
Jersey.
Oh, you up northeast? Yeah. This project was originally scheduled for New York City around March of 2020.
Okay.
And March of 2020 in New York, you know what was going on in New York. I got out just before before the virus really took hold. But I went up there in February. I was supposed to record with Ira Coleman and Rick Germanson. That was the group, and I had a singer up there, and so. But shit, when did I leave? I got March the 2nd, I think I left. And then, anyway, so I wasn't going to go back to New York, that's for sure. So I got together, got some cats down here. You know, them guys down here, the piano player, Brad Merritt, he's a doctor. He's a practicing MD.
And
the bassist, you have the record, I presume.
Mm-hmm. For you.
And the bassist, he's a professor at Greensboro, North Carolina, University of North Carolina, Greensboro. So we, it was hard getting a studio, I tell you that. So we scraped together. I knew I had an engineer down here, a guy, J.K. Lofton. I worked with him before, and so I got him, and we finally found a studio. It was difficult getting a studio, I tell you that, because the whole studio, everything was shut down, you know.
Yeah.
So we did that and got it together and did it. Singer, she's from New Orleans. I heard her, and the rapper is from New Orleans too.
Mm-hmm. So did they do their stuff remotely, or did they come to North Carolina?
Yeah, right. No, I had to send them tracks.
Ah.
That's right. Yeah, I had to send them tracks.
Mm-hmm.
We thought of about coming to North Carolina, but it was really a very bad idea in June of 2020. So we sent the tracks and did it like that.
Yeah, yeah. You recorded versions of Visions by Bobby Hutcherson and then Rio by Wayne Shorter. So, I mean, obviously mm-hmm. their music is still speaking to you. So tell me why you chose those pieces in particular.
Visions. Excuse me. Yeah, Visions. I had played Visions back in the late 60s with Hutcherson, and that particular song, that particular piece, it's voiced in such a way, the melody in conjunction with the chords and the chord progressions. That's the technical side of it, but it's a very unique way of structuring the melody with the upper parts of the chords, and it has a spiritualism that doesn't—it's beyond spiritual. It's almost has a religious feeling, tone about it. That's on the emotional side of it, and I always wanted to do that. And Rio too, Rio. We played that back when they didn't even know they called it Wayne Shorter's Bossa Nova, but that. And Wayne Shorter has his chord formations and melodies are very unique. Of course, we played it, free. There was a free, and the melody doesn't come in till the end on Rio. Everything is in the front is free improvisation off of the chords, and then we play the melody at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his band that he's had for many years now is surprisingly they go pretty far out on stage.
Oh, you're talking Wayne Shorter.
Yeah.
Well, it's I've seen this band a couple times. I would say this, that one thing about that type of free improvisation, it doesn't work too well in person. See, you're better off doing that when you establish some time, some tempo first, and then you can go out. That's what they used to say way back when we used to do that. They said, no, you got to swing first. But that would say that what we did on record, because I could do that on record. There was no audience. But doing that, no pulse, no time, that's a very hard thing for people to grasp if you're going to do that. But you can grow into that. You're more successful with that if you start off establishing a time, a pulse, a tempo, and then you can leap and go out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The track New York State of Mind Rain on this new record is... partly based on Mind Rain from your album Double Exposure. So I want to kind of ask you about that record, because I can't believe it's never been reissued on CD. What's the story there?
Well, who knows what the story is. Are you talking about the duet?
Yeah, the one with Larry Young.
Well, I don't know. I think it was reissued as a CD. A company like that, they won't, if it doesn't sell that much, what am I going to put it out for? that was my song. That, what you heard is still, the rapper Nas, you heard of him?
Mm-hmm.
Nas? Yeah, hip hop. He sampled Mind Rain, my song, back in the 90s, and we cut a little deal. But the sample that he did became almost like his signature piece. Illmatic is from, and it was literally his signature piece. Okay, and I didn't know who told me that. My son told me that. because he's the one that suggested, hey man, you should do this, you should take a relook at this, blah blah blah, you know. And he convinced me to do that, to do that. And hip-hop, the rapper, the little young rapper from New Orleans. And those are my son's lyrics. So I did it. I put it on there. And I had to watch what I say about it. You know, I had to change the writer that was asking me about hip-hop. And I he misquoted me. Anyway, so the thing about hip-hop, man, is that hip-hop grew out of the spoken word and music storytelling of the griots in Africa, see, West Africa. That can come from that. Then, see, Cab Calloway was doing rap, and I tell you what was somebody was way ahead of his time. Philly Joe Jones did a mock off of Dracula, Blues for Dracula, back in 57. Spoken word and music. He was way ahead before us. So the hip hop is not new. Rhythmic rhyme and stuff, that's not new. There was some rap when I was teenagers, back in the 50s, 14, 15, 16 years old. There was some rap songs. Guy, a song called Stranded in the Jungle. I forget the name of it. It's just like rap, just talking, and you know. So the point was that is, you know, it's not new, you know. And so so I did that out of suggestion of my son. Said, man, you should relook at Mind Rain, which that's what it is. That's what we did. And we'll see what happens with it, you know.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious about that, and you don't have to answer, but I'm just kind of curious about, because, you know, as you say, it was one of Nas's, you know, most biggest songs. So
right.
I'm just curious roughly what they paid you for the sample. Was it like enough to buy a house, enough to buy a car, or enough to buy like a week's worth of groceries?
Nas, are you talking about Nas?
Yeah.
Back then. Well, the way it goes, if you legitimately, a sampler has to pay you as the composer and also the record company that released it. In that case, that would have been Savant.
Uh-huh.
Back in those, so we made a deal between myself and the record company.
Oh, so you got part of the publishing?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, we're talking about, this is Nas paying us off for the sample, for what they do. They take us something and they loop it, you know. In this case, he took the vamp and they loop it, you know. And so, yeah, we got a little, nothing to write home about, but it was a piece of money. And this was before it actually hit, before it became a big hit, you know. So that's the way that works. That's the way that did. I guess if something becomes a hit, or these big rappers, well, Nas, he's big in himself, you know, if he continues. I can't tell you anything other than what the deal we did for Mind Rain, that it between myself and you know, the thing is, man, I gotta watch what I say, because some writer wrote something that said I had to make him change it, you know, because, you know, I would never sample what they call sample. I've heard stuff. You can hear things, and you can use pieces of things that you hear in all types of music. That go, oh, I kind of like that. I think I can do something off of that. Well, let me make a variation on that. Okay, so that's what a musician does. A true musician. A musician wouldn't take anything verbatim. verbatim and use it. That's, you know, that's the worst.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm talking about? I'm taking something verbatim. That's okay. Then I'm gonna use this. Boom, boom, boom. Okay. Then I'm gonna use this now. Man, that's a.
Yeah.
Maybe
I mean,
you could get an idea. You can get an idea from something and say, okay, I'll make a variation. You know. So this is what I said to the other writer, but the other writer wrote that I didn't like rap. You know, and I made him change that. No, it's not that. It's not. I don't dislike. I understand what rap is. Rap is what I said. It's a rhythmic rhyme that's been adopted to this culture, and other people did it before the current craze of Cap Calloway. You for me, he used to rap.
Mm-hmm.
And Philly Joe made this thing called Blues for Dracula. It was straight out like takeoff of Bela Lugosi. And with music background, and then, you know, it was big back then. It was 1957, so, you know.
Yeah. I'm curious about whether, you know, being interested in, you know, vibes and piano and stuff changes the way you think about the drums, since, you know, you're thinking chordally with a piano or with vibes, you know. Does it change the way you approach rhythm or the way you approach the kit?
Well, here's the thing. No, not really. Drumming, let me put it this way. When I was recording back in the 60s with all those people, you know, I never got a drum part. I didn't want a drum part. They would give me, like, a piano part, a trumpet part, or so I knew what was going on with all the songs.
Mm-hmm.
When I mean, I knew not only then I didn't want a drum part. It's nothing. It's stagnant. It's nothing. It doesn't. Now, if you have the piano part, hey, you got the song. You got the meat of what it is. Not only do I know rhythmically, I know chordally what the eye's moving and. You really, really know what's happening with the song, so you're able to interpret, you're able to play better with that knowledge. You're better to interpret from the role of drums as an accompanying instrument. If you know the inside of a structure, you're better able to play it and interpret it. So that's what it does. There are a lot of other reasons. There are other reasons why that I'm gonna prefer to be playing mallets these days. One thing is I don't want to play everybody I played that I like playing drums with are either gone or most of them are dead and gone. I don't want to play drums behind nobody else. Really, tell you the truth, I'll play drums for myself.
Uh huh. Well, you were saying about, you know, it being an accompanying instrument, but there's also the potential. I mean, the drummer can change the whole thing.
Oh, sure.
You know, you can challenge the guy who's up front. You can, you know.
Absolutely.
Was that
absolutely,
your thing? You know, did you like to, you know.
Well, yeah. It's still, even though you could do that, and the modern drummers did do that, they're still, their major function is as an accompanist. Believe me, I don't care how free you're going to get, you're still an accompanist. You're still, unless it's your band, of course, and you're writing the music. But, you know, Tony Williams, excuse me, he's played pretty free with Miles. He's, you know, really up front and all over the place, you know. Of course, Elvin Jones is driving. Elvin Jones was the epitome of the jazz swing. He's the epitome of it for me. So, but still, it's free as they may have gotten, they still were in an accompanying situation.
You taught for a lot of years, right? You recently retired.
I still am. No, I'm still teaching.
Oh, yeah?
I still have online. I got online students.
Oh, okay. But you were a professor at the New School for a lot of years, right?
Yeah.
So what...
And I came down here to be at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. That's what I moved down here for.
Oh, okay. Okay. And what were you teaching at the New School? I studied audio engineering there, so I'm curious. You know, were you like a...
What year were you there?
Early 2000s. I finished in 2006.
I might have still been there. Yeah, I hadn't moved down here yet. what did I teach? I taught at New School. I taught drums, of course. And improv, we all had improv classes.
Mm-hmm.
And when I had a class called rhythm analysis, it kind of says what it was. Mm-hmm. So, that's what I did down there.
And what was your approach to teaching improvisation? I'm curious because I asked Charlie Hayden about this once because he taught at Cal Arts, and you know he said he didn't worry about teaching his students theory or harmony or anything like that because he said you know they have other classes for that. He says I teach them to look at the stars, was the way he put it.
Well, improvisation is as is mostly done. And jazz is mostly a theme and variation. Theme and variation. So you don't teach free. You know, you can teach somebody to play free. So it's a combination of almost like theoretical chords, since I know a lot about chords, teaching chords, structure, how to play chords. Then the problem is in the rhythm. And so you can't, there's one thing somebody said, you can, jazz can be learned but not taught. Yeah, it can be learned but not taught. But that's just saying, you really can't teach swing. You can't teach that. That's something that has to be acquired.
Yeah.
To learn it. Apprenticeship, like an apprenticeship situation.
Yeah, and I feel like that's something that I've talked to other musicians about. They feel like the apprenticeship model, unfortunately, of like older musicians forming bands with younger musicians has kind of faded away.
It's gone. Yeah, that's a problem. Yeah, that's right. It's gotten lost. That's the main issue.
Yeah.
Because that's the way you learn. You don't really learn in school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you got a lot of bands now that are made up of people who are all the same age.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they all went to Juilliard together, or they all went to New England Conservatory together or something.
Right. That's right.
So that's my last question is because jazz has evolved a lot over the years. It's moved in a lot of different directions, like new techniques, mm-hmm. new compositional concepts. So how do you think the drums have evolved? What was the last big breakthrough from like a drummer's perspective?
Well, I would say you could say you could include talk about Milford, you know, people like what Milford and those people are doing, Sonny Murray and those people. You could say that I wouldn't, because they abandoned pulse, they abandoned swing, so it would have to be the stuff I would be included in that. And Tony, people like Tony Williams, Elvin Jones, and the people that are following, I would say that, and me, of course. Put it that way, but that would be the evolution of today.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I've been hearing a lot of players coming back to fundamentals and things like that. I mean, there's a guy that I've been listening to who, when I interviewed him, he talked about listening to Papa Joe Jones, you know, and
mm-hmm.
being hugely influenced by him. And this is in 2020, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. I could see that. I could hear that. I heard a video, a very interesting solo by Joe Jones. Just the drums. He's quite interesting.
Okay, that was my interview with Joe Chambers, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and if so, I hope you'll consider becoming a subscriber on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us to improve the website and the show. So visit patreon.com/burningambulance and throw us $5 a month if you can. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one.